Welcome to Just a Taste. I'm Scott Curry with Chef's Best. We gather to talk about the trends in marketing, retail, and production in food and beverage that are shaping the industry. Today, we are joined by Elliot Began. Elliot Began is the principal of the Intertwine Group. He serves as a consultant and thinking partner, helping emerging food and beverage brands gain the distribution and win the share of stomach that they need to grow. His articles appear in publications such as Huffington Post, Smart Brief, and Business to Community. Prior to Intertwine, Elliot was VP Sales and Marketing for Crystal Creamery under Foster Farms and held various positions in operations for Shamrock Foods Company. He claims to be a people-watching enthusiast and has proven his expertise in communication, consumer behavior, and the food industry itself, most recently helping emerging brands grow. Elliot, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Great. And before we even begin, I do want to encourage anyone listening to be sure to read and perhaps regularly follow your blog at intertwinegroup.com, where you really do get below the surface and cover a lot of insights about consumer behavior in the industry. There's a lot of blogs out there, but I know I enjoyed perusing through and reading some pretty insightful pieces. So thanks for sharing all of that with the world.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. My pleasure.
So, Elliot, why don't you share for our audience a little bit what you do for brands at Intertwine Group? And feel free to mention, you know, maybe some of the success stories you've had in helping brands grow, which I know you have.
Sure. No, I'd be happy to. You know, really what we do is whatever that brand needs. And it depends on where they are in their life cycle. And growth is a nuanced term. It means different things for different companies. You know, we have brands that growth to them means really driving top line and securing a successful exit. There are other brands that their brand is a lifestyle choice. It is what they do. It's who they are. And so growth to them is about sustainability and being able to manage a growth pattern that's going to allow them to exist and support their brand as they see fit. And so that all starts for us really with assessing where they are. And we do a deep dive in that assessment. We look at everything from, you know, their basic financials to their packaging, their products, their on-shelf positioning, their messaging, their social media, their sales approach, their sales collateral, and we just continue to go in. And really what we tell clients all the time is that if you're looking for us to come in with answers, then we're not the right fit for you. What we really do is try to come in with questions, because it's our belief and my belief that the answer is usually already in within the wisdom of the organization. They know it. They just need help getting it to the surface. And then after that, we'll spend a lot of time with brands in terms of developing their route to market, identifying, you know, what's the best way for them to go to market in terms of distribution, in terms of geography, in terms of channel, be it, you know, natural foods, retail, food service, etc., and then develop their go-to-market strategy. So now that we've identified a route, how are we going to do it? How are we going to get it on shelf? And more importantly, how are we going to get it into the cart and into your consumer's stomach? And then we do a lot of work, quite frankly, on some of the stuff that's not quite as sexy. Supply chain, you know, building out the right distribution, transportation, warehousing network, sales, mentoring, coaching, helping select and manage brokers if needed, and then execution. So we do a lot of things around accountability calls and store audits and broker audits and all the things that we need to make sure that growth trajectory is taking place. And we've worked with companies as small as 2 million to as big as multi-billion and really help them to, you know, begin to see the results they've wanted to achieve. And it's very much a customized approach.
That's great. So regardless of what their motivations are or where they are in the life cycle, your experience, you're able to help them move forward according to whatever their goals are. We'll talk about what some of those strategies and tactics that you employ are. One of the things we're going to talk a lot about today is choice from the buyer's perspective. And I think it's safe to say that you know, first of all, brands have a choice from day one, and that is to either try and be all things to all people or go after a piece of the pie and own that piece of the pie. And the latter of which is generally more successful 99 times out of 100. There's like a pretty wide graveyard of brands that try and be everything to everyone and stall there. So what for you is step one in the branding process for a new brand? Or maybe it's not a new brand, but a brand that needs to perhaps reinvent it, to how it communicates.
Well, I think the number one, and this is something that too often I think we miss in a sense of trying to get things going, is really clearly identifying who your ideal consumer is and what is that unmet need or that need that isn't being completely met. And that's the key to being able to build effective messaging, effective strategy, at least in my opinion, is really understanding that consumer, what is it that they want, and how do you deliver and meet that want.
And how does that, so after you have identified that need, and just for expedience sake, we're going to kind of skip and assume that you've developed the brand, how does that help in the fight for acquiring shelf space and then sell through as well? So let's again assume for a moment you've identified that, you know, consumers are hungering, excuse the pun, for a better X, Y, or Z, and now you are going to retail. You're ready to go to retail with that. How does a strong brand help acquire that shelf space, and what does that conversation look like with the retailer if you have a strong brand as your basis?
Well, maybe the best way to answer that is kind of to use a analogy, but I mean it's basically like meeting a person for the first time. And if that person really has an outgoing, charismatic personality, somebody that resonates with who you are, then you're more likely to want to engage with them. And that's whether you're the retailer or the consumer. So really understanding that identity and being able to make sure you bring that to that first meeting and have that engagement based on that avatar of what that consumer is, being able to communicate it well to the retailer.
Perfect. And I think that, to use maybe that dating example, I think we can all look at maybe someone and say, that person is not for me. Through that assumption, we can dismiss that person. However, from someone else's lens, that person is the ideal mate or the ideal attraction. And I think with brands, particularly as they're starting out, they fail to sometimes see and understand that it's important to appeal to someone and not necessarily be in a situation where they're saying, well, but I wouldn't choose that, so therefore it's not for me, because this, again, to just blow this example all the way out, there's 9 billion people out there. I'm not going to like or be attracted to all of them.
Right.
However, the ones that I'm not attracted to, someone else is going to say, that is it. That is perfect for me.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that's really actually an important insight that you just shared, and it's something that we talk a lot about, and that's why, coming back to that earlier point about really identifying who your ideal consumer is and being clear about that and staying within that lane, because it's kind of it's kind of the concept of essentialism, right? You're picking that one thing, that one that one persona that you're trying to meet, which means by that decision that there are going to be trade-offs, and those trade-offs are there that there are going to be others that you're not going to appeal to. There may even be others that quite frankly find you offensive or off-put if you're being on the edge. But you have to accept that and stay in that lane and be committed to that consumer if you really want to drive a brand relationship with them, again, in my opinion.
Perfect. There's such a fear, I think, of offending that sometimes people don't understand. Okay, if you're chasing a $200 million market, and if I told you, you could offend 90% of that market, but absolutely motivate and enthrall 10% of that market, Would you like that $20 million of revenue? And most, you know, most, especially at the point where they're starting out, say, yeah, I would love that. But they'll say, oh, but I don't want to offend anyone. Say, well, I'll offend 90% if I can get 10% any day, assuming I'm chasing a market that's bigger than, you know, $50,000. So let's kind of keep along the continuum here, and I want to ask about something I noticed on your in a few of your blogs, which is speed to shelf. And I want to turn it over to you and talk about, you know, how important is speed to shelf? Is it best to be quick? Is it best to be slow so that you're, you know, maybe your supply chains are set up? When you're approaching a brand, I'm sure, you know, most are ready, you know, they want to sell tomorrow. They want to, you know, be on the Safeway store shelves tomorrow. How do you either speed them up or perhaps pump the brakes a little bit when you're thinking about speed to shelf and capitalizing on trends and stuff like that?
That's a great question. It's multi-layered. So, I mean, the first thing, speed to shelf, the key thing to, in my mind is speed to shelf. The key decision factor is where you are in the life cycle of what may be a trend or a fad, right? If you're out in front and you think it's a narrow window, then you have to be fast. You have to be nimble, right? If you're the tail or if you're in the middle, you can be a little bit more prescriptive about it. That's only if you're ready. So you know, you can't be so focused on speed to shelf if you're not going to be able to support that. So you also have to have that discussion, right? Not only from a supply chain standpoint, but organizationally and from an infrastructure, and oftentimes, quite frankly, it's cash flow, because if you're really quick to shelf, that means you're really building inventory and you're holding a lot more receivables very quickly, and that can really change the look on your balance sheet. The other thing along that is if you're too forward and you're too quick, the most important aspect of it is not getting on the shelf. You know, getting on the shelf is important. It's the battle, but the war is getting into the cart. So if you have a very innovative product, something that's really far in front, and you want to get it on the shelf, but you have to educate consumers as to why it's innovative or what it's doing for them or what makes it special and try to interrupt their behaviors at the store, you better have a concrete and explicit plan that you're comfortable with being able to execute to do that. Otherwise, the risk is getting on the shelf, sitting there, and being discontinued.
Do you feel that it's getting more challenging? Because, yeah, I'm first and foremost a consumer, right? And I'm beginning, and I do the food shopping for our family 99% of the time, and which I feel like I'm starting to get overwhelmed by choice. You know, if I can think back maybe 15, 20 years ago, now, granted, I was probably in college, so we were basically chasing whatever was cheap and going to the beer aisle. But beside that point, I felt like you had three or four choices. And now it seems like every time I go to the food store, I have to make, you know, it just gets narrower and narrower and narrower. And are we reaching kind of like peak choice of overwhelming, or is... You know, on the one hand, it's good because I feel like I can completely customize my shopping cart. But on the other hand, it's almost paralysis through analysis. So from your, not sure exactly what I'm asking, but just from your perspective in dealing with emerging brands and going to industry shows where there's literally thousands and thousands of you know, new packaged foods seeking to enter the market, where are we and kind of where are we going when it comes to a shelf? Are we just going to get to the point where there's an infinite choice for things?
You know, it's really an interesting question, and I think there's some competing forces against that. I think if you go to Expo West or Fancy Food, you see all these new items and this just continued expansion of new item entrants. But at the same time, if you go to the store, Not all of that translates there because of industry consolidation and so forth. So there's kind of a juxtaposition because the industry as a whole, especially retail, has consolidated. So a lot of that innovation happens in new channels or independents and misses sometimes being at the big national retail, and they're a little bit slower. They become at best fast followers. As a consumer, I'm with you. I feel overwhelmed at times because there's so many choices. And what I see, and I don't have the data. It's really more anecdotal and a lot of conversations and also inferences drawn from the data that I do see, is that shoppers are pretty rote. We're pretty habitual in the way we shop. You know, we walk in our neighborhood store, and we tend to, either hang a right or a left, and we work our way kind of down the same aisle. I know that when I walk into another store outside of my neighborhood, I feel lost because I don't know where everything is. what's trending in my mind is that we have to be better interrupters as merchants. We have to be better interrupters as innovators to break those habits, because as a shutdown mechanism, your point, paralysis by analysis, as a shutdown mechanism, many of us have retreated more into our habits because we can't consume in our brains all these choices. So we narrow them down and just follow our patterns. So more choice, but we're looking at them less. And that's taking, in my mind, that's happening at the store, and that's why it's so important to build other mechanisms for communicating your story as a brand outside of just the shopping experience.
Right, yeah, and let's get into that. And I feel your pain, particularly, as you said, if you go to a supermarket that you've never been in and you're looking for five items, I mean, I like to say I just do figure eights. I just am up and down looking around. Yep. It could take me 45 minutes to find something, whereas at my local store, frankly, the goal for me is to be in and out as fast as I can. I mean, I don't have an interest in spending 2 hours a week shopping. I have other things I need to do in life. And really, it's up and down, and I know where the things are. So to that end, what we're talking about here is, by and large, the traditional, the packaged food industry kind of by and large is traditional, with that meaning the vast majority of the volume occurring at physical grocery locations, right? Despite major enhancements, it's still rather the same experience as it was decades ago. And however, most industries, they don't look like they did 20 years ago. But food shopping it's still food shopping, right? It's up and down the aisles, and it's eyes scanning top to bottom and stuff. So with that in mind, how is technology, the internet in particular, obviously, altered consumer behavior and shopping habits?
Oh, geez, that's a question that's, enormous in so many different ways it has, right? I mean, first of all, the obvious, right, that just all the social media and the influencers that exist, either through bloggers or blogger influencers or Pinterest or all of those things where people have more of a external experience of food before they ever walk into the store. And they're engaged with their brands, and they're engaged with other people, other foodies, and so they walk into the store with a mission. So that's one way. The other is the predictive analytics that big data is driving through your shopping experience, whether it's Dunnhumby, which is something that obviously Kroger has ownership in, but where they're monitoring, they're collecting data on your shopping behaviors, and they're predictive in that, and sending you coupons or Facebook ads or anything along those lines on the items that they think, based on those patterns, that you might be interested in, to try to do the same thing, to interrupt. And now, of course, apps that you take with you through the journey of going through a store. So, and I think that's really going to be a key driver going forward, that access at your fingertips to the things that are going to drive purchase decision on shelf.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we will have the full Amazon effect to grocery? I know back in, and I'm sure you'll remember, it's back in the bubble, 98, 99, there was one, I can't think of it, it was around the pets.com time, where it's been attempted several times for, you know, grocery store home delivery, and it, I know personally, I buy virtually everything online at this point. It's just the cost of the opportunity cost loss of going
yep.
to a place. Just is someone going to crack that code, or is perishable is one of the challenges, but is someone going to figure that out in the next 5-10 years? And obviously that would be one of the biggest disruptions probably in retail history.
Yep.
Because it affects real estate and it affects everything else. But just your thought, and we won't put you too hard on the record here, but is someone going to finally crack it? It seems like we're about almost 20 years in here and no one's cracked it yet.
Yeah, I mean, if I were clairvoyant, we probably wouldn't be having this discussion, right? But I don't know. My intuitive sense is, to a degree, yes, and it's starting to happen, you know, with Amazon Fresh and Amazon, you know, Go, and some of the things that are happening there. I think as a consumer base, as we begin to be more and more comfortable buying more and more of what we want and need online, that it's going to be a natural extension as we get comfortable. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that being very general, as consumers, you know, we weren't willing to really purchase big ticket items or consumer electronics, things along those lines online, but that's certainly changed. So I do think to a degree it will happen. I don't see it ever replacing that fill-in shopping experience or that kind of retailtainment type, you know, experience of going in. And that's why I think you see a lot of retailers trying to build experiential shopping, places where you walk in the store and there's a wine bar and a tapas grill and cooking demonstrations and all of those things, to make it an experience rather than just what you said earlier, which has always been my mindset to grocery shopping, which is, give me a list, get me in and out of there as fast as I possibly can. Those kind of shopping experiences are well suited for online, but the experiential treasure hunting type of foodie craze, I think, is better suited for brick and mortar. So I think it's going to change, and I think the industry landscape is going to be very different, and it wouldn't surprise me to see the size of a grocery store begin to shrink and more center store grocery go and move towards online, and the perimeter of the stores become the bigger feature in what drives people. So I think those things will happen. Instead of seeing those 65,000 to 100,000 square foot stores, you may go back to what I remember as a kid, you know, that 18 to 25,000 square foot store with limited SKUs is really the fill-in, and then the fresh produce, fresh meat, and experiential.
That's interesting. I think it compares to what shopping malls are doing, which is realizing, you know, going to a mall just to go to the Gap is not enough anymore, and they're transforming into lifestyle centers so that it is more of an experience as opposed to just a place to shop, because you can shop online. It'd be interesting to see what happens. I could certainly see where the footprints would get smaller, because some of the staples that people buy will be just delivered, like tin foil. I really don't need to go to a store to get tin foil now. However, if there's something else to pull me in, then into a smaller store, then I'm more apt to try and sample different foods and go on that treasure hunt. And you may see, eliminating some of the, like I said, Kleenex and toilet paper.
Right.
That can just show up at my door. I don't need to think too hard about any of those. So it's interesting. It'd be, I hope I'll recall this conversation in 5-10 years and see how it works out.
And I think the other thing that's going to drive that, not to interrupt, but I think one of the other things is going to be the technology that becomes embedded within our homes. So, you know, if we start doing more with RFID tags on products and we build RFID scanners into our appliances, you know, more and more into our refrigerators and even our cabinets and pantries and so forth, that begin to do the debiting and the credit of our household inventory for us and streamline that even more and can do predictive ordering and replenishment orders for those staples, I think that's going to help drive that as well. So
that's a great point. And to start to bring it full circle, I think marketing and brand marketing and loyalty to brands and using the internet to gain awareness of a product is going to be that much more important, because if you are going to the food store less, and that means that you need to get in front of the consumer in a different location, which is where we spend our entire life, which is online, which is where you'll need to develop the content to reach people, to attract them in that location, as opposed to in end cap or something like that. So thankfully, the future is bright for marketing.
I couldn't agree more. And I think the future is bright for food, because I just think that consumers, you know, really want stories. They eat stories more than just product. And and I think that you know, there's a growing awareness. I have three millennials, and they're very, very aware of our growing need to be, you know, feeding 9 billion people by 2050, and they're very sensitive to the triple bottom line of, you know, of brands that are doing right by people, product, and profits. And I think, you know, that's going to play well to marketing. It's also going to keep innovators and entrepreneurs busy for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You often draw inspiration from Peter Drucker, and among his many credos is using data to make decisions and becoming data literate. What sorts of data do you ask the brands you work with to track and then interrogate?
That really depends on the size of the brands, and you know, obviously, ideally, it's always great to get syndicated data, you know, SPINS or IRI or Nielsen, just because it's just great information to have. But for many brands, and not even small brands, mid-sized brands as well, it's prohibitively expensive to buy at any kind of depth that is too useful. So although I am a Drucker fan and a data lover and a bit of a nerdy bean counter, I also think that qualitative data is equally important. And so one of the things I encourage brands to do is be in front of your consumers routinely so that you can listen to them and be in the stores and listen to the store people and talk to the personnel who's stocking your shelves and, you know, ordering the category, because that qualitative data is sometimes as impactful, if not more. Sometimes it's in front of trends than the qualitative data that you buy through syndication. And then, of course, obviously, you're wanting to look at, you know, one of the things that is so critical in my mind is promotion. You're spending a lot of money in promotion, and sometimes you get lured into believing that having a strong promotional campaign, you know, doing a lot of volume on deal or having a high frequency is the right thing to do. But if you don't look at lift, and then after lift, if you don't measure base business, and if you're not seeing kind of a terraced growth, that if you run a promotional event, you get lift, and after that lift, your base business grows with it, then you could be just spending money and subsidizing your base business. And so it's really important to have an idea, you know, to have an understanding of why promote, what a successful promotion looks like, and then measure against it. So qualitative data and promotional data would be the two things. If and third would be if your budget allows, buying syndicated data.
Great. So so promotionally, you're looking for increased plateaus and not spikes that just canyon out
right
each time.
You're going to get pantry stocking, and you're going to subsidize base business. In other words, you're not winning new consumers to your product. You're in fact training your consumers that if they buy every 3 weeks, they can wait for a promotional price.
Exactly. Awesome. So I know I learned a lot today. We talked about looking forward a little bit about the evolving retail landscape, and I think that we can all agree that marketing is going to play an increasingly important role as consumers continue to shift towards a few things. One is purchasing and researching online so that they are a little bit more, let's call it, pre-programmed before they enter the retail store. That as we've known in a lot of industries, increasingly in food, people are looking to consume or eat stories and be able to share those stories with people, as opposed to just, eating the same saltines and not talking about it. They want to understand what they're eating, why they're eating it, the stories behind that, and share that with friends, which I think is great for food, because I think using apparel as an example, apparel has always been about the stories and in the car you drive reflecting, who and what you are, that we're heading in that direction for food. And folks like yourself, as a said, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, a proclaimed people watcher and just fascinated by behavior, stand to really help a lot of brands in the future as the industry continues to evolve. So I want to thank you for sharing your thoughts today with our listeners, and wish you the best of luck as you keep helping brands tell their stories, get to market, experience success, and whatever that success is for them, you offer that customized approach to help them out. We'll stay on top of things as things emerge and change, and maybe we'll check back in with you and see how these forecasts come out.
Yeah, I think we need to put in our calendars, to your point, a date 10 years from now and see how good we both were at predicting the future of food. My track record has not always been so great as being a predictor of the future.
Hey, so, if we were perfect, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing now. I'd be on an island.
That's right. Yep, you and me both. But thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much, Elliot. Take care. Thank you for joining us on Just a Taste, the Chef's Best production. Join us again next time as we talk to more experts in marketing, retail, and production in the food and beverage industry. As always, visit chefsbest.com to learn more.